Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzschreiber, your host. On today's show, the basics of Bitcoin, as Bitcoin has become an increasingly viable alternative currency adopted by a growing number of people, it's still kind of an obscure thing. I've worked in tech policy for almost 2 years, and I don't really understand how it works. Maybe that's because I'm bad at my job, or maybe because I haven't had someone explain it to me. So joining me to discuss this is Michael Bombas, Law and Policy Adjunct Fellow at Tech Freedom. Michael, thank you for joining us. So let's start with the most basic of questions. Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, virtual currency, what the hell is it?
It's many things. At base, it's really software. And I think, you know, for the hardcore Bitcoin crowd, you definitely can get lost in the weeds and you start talking about mining and all these more advanced concepts. So I think for most people, it's helpful to just start with things that you already know. So reasoning by analogy a little bit. And Bitcoin is really software and you can download it. It's open source. Anyone can go get it. And then there's the underpinnings of it that matter a lot. And those core pieces are the blockchain, which is the underlying technology. And then Bitcoin, as it's talked about, is really the use of blockchain for payments. And that's really the excitement and sort of the quantum leap forward for computer science and even for the movement of money was blockchain. And they sort of came together at once, but they are different. Bitcoin, as it's used now, is for payments. Blockchain can be used for different things because it's a new type of technology and in particular a protocol. And a protocol is just a set of standard procedures for how two people interacting will do something. And that's really exciting because protocols are the backbone of the internet, and blockchain is sort of this new step forward for, I think, the internet because it is totally distributed, meaning there's no central party like a Visa, a bank, a central bank for the government even, where if I send you money, there's some third party there who will both create the currency or create the payment system. They will move the money and then they will record it. And with blockchain, the software, the technology itself, it actually acts as the third party. So there's no central party. It's just everyone in the network working together.
So just so listeners might understand the protocol thing a little bit, there's a lot of protocols that we interact with on a daily basis when you access Gmail or when you send messages to other people. So what are some internet protocols that have been around for a while that people might not even know that they're participating in, and how is that different than something like the blockchain?
Oh, absolutely. So the internet is, like you said, built on several protocols, and that's how it can be a global phenomenon, and it can cross continents, it can cross languages. It's really powerful. And one of them is when you look up in your web browser, there's an HTTP, and sometimes there's an HTTPS, which is a little bit safer, more secure. That's what the S stands for. Topic of a different podcast, which I encourage people to check out. So HTTP stands for Hypertext Transfer Protocol, and it's oftentimes that little blue highlighted text that you see, you can click, and it will send you to another website. Seems like a simple thing. It's quite powerful. It's how you can connect several documents and route people across the internet. And it's interesting, that protocol is not unlike the blockchain in that in order for me to send Bitcoins, the virtual currency of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is, should have covered this in the beginning, but so Bitcoin's both software, so it's the network as a whole, and then it's the virtual currency itself. So big capital B Bitcoin is the network, lowercase b is the virtual currency of the network. And
learn something new every day.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny, early papers in the space would mix that up, but it's nice that that's been set. But for the internet and for the online space, protocols are everything, and it sounds like a fancy word. It's really just a standard procedure. So HTTP, you may have heard of TCP/IP folks out there. Blockchain is just another type of protocol, and it's a protocol for moving money.
So you mentioned earlier that Bitcoin and the blockchain often get roped together, but blockchain could actually be used for other things. So I guess in order to fully understand how Bitcoin works, you have to understand the blockchain. And you also hear the term ledger thrown around a lot. And I guess if Bitcoin is functioning as an intermediary, and you say it's like you don't need a bank, that the protocol itself serves as the third party, then how exactly does this ledger work?
Oh, absolutely. So the blockchain is the ledger. It's also a database. It's also, you know, a record of account. And those words are thrown around sort of interchangeably, and they are to a certain point. And as the underlying technology, like you said, it's really critical to understand. So it's at base, the blockchain is ledger, meaning it tracks who sent who what, and the what is Bitcoin. And it does this in a couple different ways. Again, blockchain is just software. It's open source software, which is really important to understand because it means that the source code, that how it's written, how it's built, is open for anyone to see. And that has a really...
So this is not some proprietary thing that, you know, someone has patented, whereas maybe your bank has proprietary software that they use to transfer money. When you say open source, anyone can use it or anyone can download it. There's no, you don't have to pay for it, and there's no copyright protection or anything like that.
Exactly.
Right?
And that plays very large in what we'll get to later and even future podcasts, is that in, I'll get to your original question here in just in a split second with blockchain, but because it's open source, it's permissionless and anyone can look at it. Anyone can build on it to a certain point, and anyone can improve upon it and make a new version. And that's incredibly powerful. And so the building on that, the blockchain is publicly visible for anyone to look at. So the record of account of who sent who, how many Bitcoins and when, is available for anyone to see. Now, it's not the type of information that you would normally think of with a transaction, like your name and address. That stuff's not included. And
yeah, I was going to say, I mean, is this like having my entire bank statement on the internet for everyone to look at when you say that?
That'd be terrifying,
it's
right?
It's permissionless. Yeah, that'd be pretty terrifying. So
donut
what
purchases.
If you say that it keep right, exactly. So if you say that it keeps track of, you know, who sent whom what, are these like anonymous names? I mean, how do you protect people's identity if it's all public?
True. So building blocks. So we'll walk through it pretty quick. So the blockchain is really a chain of blocks. And punning aside, each individual block, there was originally one block. The word block might throw people for a loop, especially when you start talking about mining, but it's really straightforward. Each block is just a turn of a page, as if a page is, you know, who sent who what. And each block requires the prior block based on how the software is written, but also because it references back to the original creation of that individual Bitcoin. And so in a sense, it's like the sale of property. You can't sell your home unless you can prove that you actually own it. So for the blockchain, it's able to do this based on how the software is written. So each block is just a moment in time that states this is who owns which individual or which Bitcoins. And in a later technical podcast, we'll get into the particulars. But, you know, for now, it's really, you know, every 10 minutes, the network will say this is who owns what. And then in the next 10 minutes, it will record what transactions have occurred, and it builds on the last block. So that when you look at the blockchain, it is a full history of everything that has occurred. And when I say, you know, who sent who what, you know, back in 2009 when blockchain sort of sprung to life and was created, and the first block was mined or created into existence, the who is a public address, and that's a string of random numbers, and it's there and letters, and it's there to serve as both a sort of send and receive like an email address. And your identity, your name, your date of birth, your address, and a say an identification card, all requirements for anti-money laundering as a customer identification program, if you go to a bank or even a Bitcoin exchange now and you want to purchase Bitcoins, that's done separately. That's not a part of the software, and that's not required for you to send or receive Bitcoins through the software itself. So it's just that address, and you're sending and receiving Bitcoins to and from that address.
And that's, so just to kind of recap what we've gone through so far, the blockchain sounds fancy, but really it's just a ledger, it's a history, it's a record of transaction, and rather than showing your name and address or things that a bank might show, it just shows a number that, can you be identified by that number, or is it just there to make sure that, you know, my money's my money, his money's his money, but I can't tell who exactly it is? Because when you say it's open source and anyone could access it, I guess a question that a listener might have is, okay, so this number that is publicly available for anyone to see, and I'm sending money to another number, can that identify me?
So that is a deep topic of debate, actually. And then you start getting into some privacy implications, some things that were really near and dear to my heart early on in Bitcoin. And the answer is it depends. And it depends on how much activity you have, whether you disclose that to anyone, and just your general activity with that account. Like so much else online, it depends on what you do in the time of day, and you can create a profile over time of just raw activity, and you can be identified through that. So this actually sort of trips over into the privacy debate somewhat, because based on your GPS coordinates in your phone and how you handle your daily walk, whether it's to work or the grocery store or to a local bar, that can actually identify you through certain research studies almost or more effectively than a fingerprint. Which is pretty potent. So the same thing applies for that address. So for the listener, what's sort of good to hear is that some of the software out there will create a new address for you each time, so that you can have some privacy. And it's also really hard to identify, and there's not quite the vast amount of activity on the network to do that quite yet. And then the other thing just to keep in mind is that when I say access the ledger, you're just looking at the movements. That's not actually getting access to it and changing it. That's not quite possible because of how the network is secured by the software and by everyone using it. And the network continues to grow, so more and more people are added. It becomes a little bit safer each day. And so, yeah.
And so I guess, yeah, since we've kind of almost tripped into some other debates that will be for other podcasts, we'll get back to it. So we've kind of got a sense of how it works, how the blockchain functions kind of like a ledger. I guess the real question is, what makes this different from a traditional fiat currency? Because Bitcoin is traded on a global market, and at any given time, one Bitcoin equals X amount of US dollars or euros or whatever. What makes this so different than just the currency that a treasury manages in a country?
Great question, and actually a great way to recap sort of what it is and then both why it matters and even some of its history all at once. So, you know, Bitcoin is blockchain at the moment. They're sort of one and the same. Blockchain is this underlying technology, and it helps payments. And its genesis is part of this lineage of sorts of both private virtual currencies online that were centralized and trying to make them more secure and private, trying to have some semblance of privacy, and also sort of the evolution of just payments online. And it came about at a time when the financial collapse was going on and there were huge bank bailouts. And what's interesting is that the blockchain answered a couple of questions. The big question from a computer science standpoint is something called the Byzantine general problem, and that is relevant to both the movement of money and the creation of a distributed ledger, but also how do you get multiple parties to agree and work together if there's no unifying point like an overarching king for several generals wanting to attack a central point.
Or like a bank or a credit card company that could theoretically address fraud if it happens, or fulfill someone who was wrongly, their money was stolen, or is that kind
not
of
not quite. The Byzantine general's problem is really how do you get people to work together if there's no central third party governing them, like a higher level king or something. And so for a bank, the bank is that higher level central third party entity. Just like if I send you an email, Google is the one to do it. If there was no Google and you and I were messaging back and forth, something's going to have to allow that. Because in today's world, we are so reliant on third parties or really middlemen to help us do certain things. Food, water, basic services, email, etc., movement of money. So the blockchain was really this huge moment in time for computer science, but also for everything else. And the first thing is money. So the blockchain, how does it do that? And you know, why is it relevant? Is that it's open source software, anyone can use it, and it's totally distributed and to a point decentralized, meaning anyone can use it. There's no Bitcoin company. There's no single Bitcoin company, and there's no single person that's running the show. It's really a huge network of users working together through the software to both create the virtual currency Bitcoin, move it, so basically transition it from point A to point B. That's a gloss on the technicality of exactly how it's done, but for our discussion, that's what it is. And then to record it. So every function, close to every function that happens for a regular payment network, say with a Western Union or even a bank, if you have a mobile wallet, is being done by blockchain and the software itself to move and record Bitcoin transactions. And what's interesting about that is that it's actually creating the virtual currency too in timed sequence. So every 10 minutes, there is a certain small amount of Bitcoins that are put into production. And there's a cap based on how the software was written and those who wrote it, with the decision that there should be a cap of 21 million and it wouldn't be inflationary and that you could continue to create more and more currency like the most central banks do, which is interesting because, you know, at a certain point there will be no more Bitcoins created and we'll have the whole volume of them in circulation, or at least they can be moved.
And that, I guess, gets to the traditional issue of money supply. The more money that is in supply, it's worth less. And you have a lot of, we talked on a previous podcast, of a lot of governments who, facing financial woes, will just print money because they think that'll solve problems. But it creates massive inflation. You see that in Zimbabwe. And it's interesting that Bitcoin has a built-in mechanism to guard against that, so that you can't just create unlimited Bitcoins. And I guess the purpose of the software in trying to find that magic number of all the Bitcoins being created is sound money, is a system where there's a certain amount of money, it holds its value, and it doesn't get diluted by a government that's just looking to print more of it.
True. And that was a huge reason for Bitcoin. And actually, I think it's podcast 29 that you're referencing, which I suggest listeners go back and check out, because I think a lot of these, in true fashion and dedication to the cause of Bitcoin, these podcasts will reference each other and sort of build out their own little network. But yeah, that's absolutely it. And it's actually kind of funny because the first block, that 10-minute chunk of time where the first Bitcoin transaction was recorded, you can embed messages in a Bitcoin transaction. The message had a little comment on bank bailouts, basically. So I think the individual that we think, or at least the name that is associated with both the white paper, which I think people should go read, is Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. You can find it at bitcoin.org. That white paper, and then later the actual software itself, was written and then created by someone called Satoshi Nakamoto. Could be an individual, could be a group, but they clearly had an axe to grind and concern about unlimited printing of money and bank bailouts. And it's an experiment. I think ultimately Bitcoin is still an ongoing experiment. It's now larger and more global and more interconnected with the current financial system than it was in 2009 when very few people heard about it. And you could buy a pizza for 10,000 Bitcoins. I think Bitcoin now is around the $440 mark. Based on the value that people give it, and they think that the network has value. So this ongoing experiment will be really interesting to see what type of an impact it has on both the creation of money in its own right, but the impact it has on central banks and whether the technology is adopted by others or even changes policy to a certain extent.
So to wrap up the basics of Bitcoin, and we'll of course have other podcasts to follow up on this, but one of the terms that gets thrown around a lot is mining, mining Bitcoin, and that might be difficult for someone to understand, whereas today I think we've explained what the blockchain is and how this came about and how it's decentralized. But what does that term mining even mean? What does it mean to mine Bitcoin?
That is central to the experiment and to the software. That's what makes it secure and makes it possible to have a distributed ledger, so there's no central party that controls everything. So mining is really the donation of computer cycles. And what that means is in the very beginning, I could download software. I could download the Bitcoin software on my laptop, and I could use my computer to process transactions for the network. And originally you could do it with just a basic laptop, and it's become more and more competitive because this process of gaming a little bit, where the first person to confirm those transactions that I talked about in that 10-minute window, everyone in the whole network is competing against each other to confirm transactions first. And they do that through the software, how it's written. And if you and I are the only two people on the network using the software and I send you Bitcoins, then if I solve the transaction first, then I will actually add that block, that 10-minute period of time, to the transactional history in saying that I confirm the transaction. And I'm doing that through a process called mining. And mining is kind of like my computer taking a pair of dice, rolling them, and getting as close to a determined number based that the software has in mind to get to. And it's really just a series of math puzzles and a way of thinking. And you can certainly get lost in the weeds on that for sort of the lay listener. The core takeaway is that you're using your computer to crunch numbers and secure the network and secure those transactions and then add them to the history, that ledger, the chain of blocks or the blockchain. And over time, it's just become more competitive. So people now have entire mining farms. So they have basically entire warehouse is full of computers that are dedicated to nothing but mining Bitcoin instead of people just on their laptops.
What's the incentive? You say compete. What's the incentive to be first to confirm a transaction?
Remember, a brief bit ago, I mentioned that the software itself will set in predetermined time every 10 minutes that it will put into circulation a tiny bit of Bitcoin. It will do that. That's the reward. It's called a block reward. So every time a block is confirmed by one miner, and now it can be a large group of miners that pool their resources together, each group is competing, and the first person to win or confirm the block through the software, the software will in turn, once they confirm it, will give them a block reward of a certain amount of Bitcoins. And this is done on a sort of a production arc of sorts. In the beginning, it was 50 Bitcoins per block every 10 minutes, and then it will half over a predetermined set of time. There's a little bit of wiggle room there based on, you know, how many people are in the network, but over time it will halve, called a halving event. And we've had one already where it dropped to 25 Bitcoins per block. We'll have one coming up in the not so distant future again. And that is how they're put into production. And that's one of the incentives. The other incentive is that a fee can be charged when you send Bitcoins, and the miner who basically processes the transaction and allows it in that block will get a fee from it. Sort of like if you send money from Western Union from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco to buy me a beer, for perhaps, then Western Union will charge you a small fee. So there's two incentives, really, at the moment.
Basically, there's incentives to participate, and because it's a decentralized system, it wants to have some type of reward for the people who allow their computer to be part of the network and to contribute to this wonderful decentralized thing. Now, I guess just to wrap up, since we're running low on time, one of the controversies about Bitcoin is just the constant fluctuation in its value. And since it's only, I guess, 6 years old, even a tinfoil hat wearing libertarian like myself is very reluctant. I'm very reluctant to go away from the tried and true US dollar to do something like take my salary in Bitcoin, which a lot of tinfoil hat wearers like to do. How does it gain and lose value against other currencies, and what was all that volatility about? And do you see, as it grows in popularity, a stabilization that will allow it to really be an alternative currency? I mean, what's going on with all this like fluctuation, and what do you say to people who would say, I'm too worried, it seems unsafe, I don't want to put my money in Bitcoin?
I'll give my personal view, and I'll also sort of argue two other points as well. So Bitcoin gets its value based on people's belief in it. There are folks out there that would say, you know, the value of Bitcoin is nothing more than, you know, people's expectation in it, and it's not based on anything. It's not backed.
That's similar to other currencies too. I mean, you know, the reason that the U.S. dollar is relatively high these days is because people have faith in the treasury, they have faith in bonds, and they have faith that the U.S. dollar will retain its value. So I guess in that way, it's similar to any other currency. It's just people believing that this is worth something.
That's a good example. The reason the dollar has value is both the political stability of the U.S., our large military. I think that helps. Some people will joke we're a destabilizing force. I think we're typically a stabilizing force. But it's a stable economy. There's a military to both defend and back it up where necessary, and a really large trade network. And people believe in the U.S. and they believe in the dollar to hold value and to act as, you know, a medium of exchange and a unit of account. So same thing with Bitcoin. It's this huge network of users, miners working together, and it's growing popularity that there's increased value and that it is stabilized a little bit. Volatility, you know, in the early days, it would go from a penny. There was a price spike up of $31. That was tied in large part to, people think, an article about Silk Road, which was this early drug marketplace online, and an article in Wired. And then there was even a price spike upwards over $1,000, pretty close to the 1200 mark, because of speculation as trading bots, interest in activity in China. So it's not unlike, which is why certain regulators are looking at it like a commodity if it's used like that, that it be traded like a commodity, and in certain instances sort of like a stock, where speculation, even abuse, early days there might have been pump and dump schemes, so there's some consumer protection issues there. But it's really the value in the network, value people think it has or will have. So.
All right. Well, that's it for today's show. This will hopefully be the first of many episodes where we attempt to explain this very exciting yet very obscure technology. And I think it's fair to say that most people are probably still pretty at a pretty elementary level of understanding Bitcoin. So it's really important to understand this technology, because the blockchain, as you said, is not the same as Bitcoin. It is a technology that enables payments, and the blockchain could be used for all sorts of other things. And the potential for decentralization is really limitless here, as more and more things can be taken out of institutions' hands, centralized banks, centralized governments, and be done on a peer-to-peer basis. So this is really exciting stuff. And my guest has been Michael Bombas, a Tech Freedom Adjunct Fellow. Mike's, thanks so much for joining us.
Talk to you soon.
Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us and help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.